Hello there, Captain Jeff here, walking the streets of New York in search of lunch. And after that is accomplished, I'll be heading back to my hotel room to record Airline Pilot Guy, episode number 9. Don't go anywhere. Jeff here, your airline pilot guy, and welcome to the Airline Pilot Guy podcast, the place where I talk about aviation-related news and commentary. Sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. Today I'm in New York City once again at the Roosevelt Hotel on Madison and 45th. And it's a beautiful day here in New York. It's a little bit warm, but it's kind of warm everywhere, isn't it? Let's see. Let's get started with some news. Well, as you probably know, the third preliminary report was released on Friday in French of the Air France 447 flight that crashed a little over 2 years ago now. It crashed on June 1st, 2009. And let's see, the France's Bureau of Investigations and Analysis, or also known as
Bureau d'enquête et d'analyse pour la sécurité de l'aviation civile.
Right. I have no idea what she just said, but I think that's the French version of the Bureau of Investigations and Analysis. Anyway, they, as I mentioned, they released their third preliminary report in French on Friday. And while it doesn't appear that there have been additions to the factual part already released in report number 2, this report contains the first analysis of the crash. And it also released the transcript. And with some analysis and some recommendations as well. Now, this is not the final report, but the sources say that they don't expect the final report will have a lot of additional information or recommendations. So, remember, this occurred about 3 hours and 40 minutes into the flight when the captain, right after the captain decided to take his rest break. And so he left the cockpit, and after a brief, not really a briefing, I guess it was, yeah, a brief briefing to the two first officers. There were, let's see, one was the pilot flying with the least amount of time. He was in the right seat, and the pilot not flying was in the took over the captain's position in the left seat. And shortly after the captain left, they noticed some returns of radar returns and some possible turbulence. And because of that, they decided they would make a little bit of a left turn, 12 degrees to the left of their current course, to try to avoid some of the turbulent air. And let's see, the pilot flying remarked he would prefer to climb to flight level 360 at the time. I think they were at 35,000 feet or 34. And then they noticed some intensive weather radar observations. And the report mentions that it was interrupted by a sensation of quick temperature increase and the appearance of an odor that distracted the crew for more than a minute. The pilot not flying finally identified the smell as ozone. Let's see, the discussions in the cockpit did not suggest any malfunctions. And a couple minutes later, the background noise in the cockpit on the cockpit voice recorder significantly changed. The BEA analyzed the sound was consistent with the characteristics of presence of ice crystals. the change in sounds getting the attention of the first officers who had not experienced this sound before. The pilot not flying takes action and suggests that they slow down the aircraft to Mach 0.8 and engage the engine anti-ice on. Shortly thereafter, a sharp drop of airspeed indications occur, likely due to an obstruction of the pitot probes by ice crystals. The autopilot and autothrust systems disengaged as a result. The presence of turbulence led to the aircraft rolling right to a bank angle of 8 degrees. The nose pitches up to 11 degrees nose up within 10 seconds. The pilot flying announces, "I have control," and makes a quick left nose up input almost to the mechanical stops of the side stick. The nose pitches further up just a couple seconds later, the stall warning activates. Let's see. The pilot not flying reads various ECAM messages and then attracts the attention of the pilot flying to the loss of speed. At that time, both the left hand and ISIS airspeeds, I believe that's the standby instrumentation system, were below 100 knots. The aircraft was climbing 7,000 feet per minute, and the aircraft was rolling left and right with the bank angle remaining within minus 10 and plus 10 degrees of bank as a result of the pilot flying inputs. Okay, let me repeat that again. Okay, they're flying on at very high altitude. They're in turbulence. The autothrottle and autoflight systems stop working. They basically are in manual mode now. And the reaction that the pilot flying has is to pull back almost to the stops on the stick. And the aircraft is climbing 7,000 feet per minute. Okay. Those of you out there who are pilots know that that is just a very strange reaction to have, especially up at high altitude in a very, you know, heavy airplane. Both first officers recognized the loss of airspeed indications. However, none of them called for the unreliable airspeed procedures. Comparing the three airspeed indications, the pilot not flying urges the pilot flying multiple times to lower the nose. At this point, the aircraft was climbing through flight level 370, 37,000 feet, and continuing to climb. 29 seconds later, after this whole sequence of events starts, when the autopilot and autothrottle is disconnected, the left airspeed sharply rises to 215 knots and becomes valid again. The speed indication of the standby instrumentation system remains erroneous. The BEA analyzed that the speed was 60 knots from the point of autopilot disengagement until that time, the 60 knots loss of speed being consistent with the aircraft climbing 2,000 feet in that configuration. And 42 seconds after the event starts, the thrust levers were moved to about two-thirds of travel, resulting in 85% N1. Now, 85% N1 is the normal, for most airplanes, is the normal power setting or thrust setting to maintain level flight at most of the higher altitudes. So that was a good idea to put that at that position. The climb rate was reduced to 100 feet per minute. Okay, so they're almost level. The angle of attack reduced to about 3 degrees. Again, that's probably a very normal pitch attitude. And the roll is controlled. Okay, so at this point, 42 seconds after they lost the airspeed and the autoflight and autothrottle systems, it looks like they have it under control. The first officers now attempt to call the captain back to the cockpit. The BEA analyzes that after a quick trim and leveling off, as a result of pilot flying inputs, the trajectory of the aircraft appeared controlled. However, the initial increase in altitude was excessive and should have been pointed out by the pilot not flying. However, none of the pilots called out speeds, vertical speeds, pitch angles, or altitude. Okay, communication is in play here. No communication. Okay, at 46 seconds after the initial event, the stall warning activated again. The pitch angle had increased to about 6 degrees nose up. As a result of pilot flying inputs, the pitch angle increased from 6 to 13 degrees and the angle of attack increased to 10 degrees. Rapid onset of buffeting occurred. 5 seconds later, the thrust levers are placed in the TOGA detent, and TOGA stands for Take Off Go Around. In other words, pretty much the highest setting while still protecting the engines. The BEA analyzed that this was about the point where the aircraft went out of control. Okay, so just 4 to 5 seconds after they seemingly had the aircraft under control in level flight, albeit a couple thousand feet above their assigned cruise altitude, just 4 or 5 seconds after that, for some reason, the aircraft is now again out of control due to the inputs made by the pilot flying. Again, I'd like to remind you that the pilot flying at this point is the least experienced crew member on that crew. The captain, with about 11,000 hours of flying time, is in the rest bunk, or the rest seat. The pilot not flying, the one that's sitting in the left seat at this point, has about 6,500 hours of flying time. And the pilot flying at the controls, when the aircraft gets out of control, has less than 3,000 hours total flying time. Okay, the pilot flying maintains inputs to keep the nose up between 11 and 23 degrees nose up, with the angle of attack being between about plus 11 and plus 18 degrees. 1 minute, 2 seconds after the initial event, the standby airspeed becomes valid at 183 knots. All three indicated airspeeds agree. The total time that the airspeed indicators were not reliable would be just over a minute. And actually, the primary airspeed indicators were working or not working for only about 29 seconds. Okay. Let's see. The vertical speed drops through zero and becomes highly negative, around 4,000 feet per minute sink rate. The airspeed reduces further to 160 knots. Now, I'm not sure if they thought that the airspeed was still unreliable at this point, and they thought that they were going much faster or what, because they still have the pilot flying still has the stick up full back, all the way against the nose up stops. The aircraft is sinking at 4,000 feet per minute. 1 minute, 15 seconds after the initial event, the pilot flying states twice he has lost control of the aircraft. 1 minute, 32 seconds, the pilot not flying pushes the priority button and provides a large left input in reaction to a high right bank, calling controls on the left. He almost instantly released the priority button and ceased control inputs again without required calls. Okay, the point they're making here, again, this is communication. When we're in an airplane, even when we're taxiing the airplane, when we're clear for takeoff, whatever, anytime that control is transferred to another pilot. At the company I fly for, we always say, you have the aircraft, and the person taking the aircraft says, Roger, I have the aircraft, or something to that effect. Even if it's on the autopilot, we always have to know who is in control of the aircraft, or actually making inputs to the autoflight system. So at this point, the pilot not flying, you know, intervenes to help recover the aircraft momentarily. And he just mentions quickly that he has control, and then he releases control without letting the other guy know. Don't know if this is a factor or not. 1 minute, 37 seconds later, the captain enters the cockpit. Okay, so from the moment that the airspeed is lost and the autothrottles and autoflight system kick off, less than 2 minutes later, the captain is now back in the cockpit. So obviously he is feeling something going on back there. Something is wrong. So it gets back into the cockpit. Let's see. The airplane was at 35,800 feet, 9,100 feet per minute sink rate. Airspeeds below 100 knots, pitch 12 degrees nose up, and engines at 102% N1. Okay. So basically we have full power in the engines without pushing the throttles to the stops. Neither first officer provides an account to the captain of what is happening. Let's see, there's a note here in the report that the BEA analyzed that when the stall warning stopped, all three angle of attack computations had become invalid due to too low an airspeed. Airspeeds are no longer displayed on the pilot or the primary flight displays. So that is probably adding to the confusion here. You know, the computer systems say, okay, the airspeed's below 60 knots. Obviously, that can't be right, so I'm not going to display any airspeed information. Also, there are no angle of attack displays to the pilot crew. This is all just data that they retrieved from the flight data recorders. Okay, right at about 2 minutes after the initial event, the pilot flying remarked he believed that they were in overspeed. The BEA assumes, because of the excessive background noise in the cockpit, none of the other two pilots supported that hypothesis, which was in contradiction to instrument indications, high pitch angle and high rate of descent. Okay, so there is a lot of confusion going up here. They're not really sure what is happening. They're not sure if they have a reliable airspeed indicator. They are hearing a lot of noise, a lot of engine noise, because they have these things at full power. They hear a lot of air noise, which sounds to the pilot flying that they're going too fast. Until impact, now the stall warning activates when the nose is lowered and silences when the pitch angle increases. The flight data recorder data suggests that as soon as the stall warning activates, the pilots react with nose-up inputs, which cause the stall warning to silence again. Okay, so here we go. Here's a scenario. They're in a big, full aerodynamic stall. They're dropping like a brick, and the computer system is not giving them any airspeed information because their airspeed is below 60 knots, and at that point, it stops giving them the stall warning. Okay, so maybe they think they're not in a stall and they're just going too fast, hence the reason for trying to climb. Or, well, I don't know what the other option is there. But every time that they lowered the nose to actually start initiating a stall recovery, the airspeed goes over 60 knots. The computer system says, okay, I have valid airspeed now. And, oh, by the way, my angle of attack is extreme. I'm in a stall, so it starts giving the stall warning. Again, the crew hears the stall warning. Immediately, they start pulling the nose all the way back. Okay, you see how this is going all the way down for almost 40,000 feet for almost 4 minutes, in and out, stall warning activating, stall warning stopping. So apparently none of the three pilots ever worked out which indications to trust and which not. Let's see, the BEA analysis said that both first officers have been trained unreliable airspeed emergency maneuvers at low altitude, which required them to disengage flight directors and autoflight systems, then adopt an attitude between 10 to 15 degrees nose up. At altitude, however, in other words, at high altitudes, the stall warning would activate at an angle of attack just above plus 4 degrees. So obviously the training that they had for unreliable airspeed maneuvers to put the pitch attitude between 10 and 15 degrees nose up at low altitudes was not really applicable for this regime of flight up at high altitude. Let's see. Some of the other findings by the investigation. The co-pilots had received no high altitude training for unreliable indicated airspeed procedure and manual aircraft handling. No standard call-outs regarding the difference in pitch attitude and vertical speed were made. Let's see. Engines were operating normally throughout the entire event. The aircraft was operating normally, actually. Let's see. By design, when the speed measurements were lower than 60 knots, the three angle of attack values become invalid. The stall warning was triggered continuously for 54 seconds. Let's see. The airplane's angle of attack was not directly displayed to the pilots. I already talked about that. And the last thing they put here, no announcement was made to the passengers. I'm not sure why they put that in there. I'm not sure why that is even something to be a consideration. At this point, they're completely confused. They're trying to recover an aircraft. I don't think this is the time to make an announcement that everybody make sure they have their seatbelts fastened, because in the end, of course, it didn't make any difference. Let's see. Air France commented, it should be noted that the misleading stopping and starting of the stall warning alarm Contradicting the actual state of the aircraft greatly contributed to the crew's difficulty in analyzing the situation. Let's see. They have the transcript here. I'm not going to read the transcript, but it'll just turn your stomach to hear some of the things that they were saying and what they were experiencing and the frustration that they had during the whole thing. Now, in another article, I believe this was out of the New York Times, they talk about pilot training issues. And the report called for a series of significant changes to pilot training procedures to help flight crews respond appropriately when they run into trouble at high altitudes. And the investigators urge European and French air safety regulators to re-examine existing programs for pilot training and skills maintenance, and in particular to make mandatory the creation of regular specific exercise aimed at manual aircraft or manual airplane handling. Similar training should be required in recognizing the approach to and recovering from high altitude stalls. Let's see, William R. Voss, the president of the Flight Safety Foundation in Alexandria, Virginia, said that the lack of sufficient training for high altitude upsets was not unique to Air France. There is not really time being devoted anymore to these issues, Mr. Voss said in a telephone interview. It's a problem across the industry. And let's see, longtime safety regulations requiring strict vertical separation of airplanes in the air have meant that pilots no longer fly manually at altitudes above 24,500 feet. They never get to feel what the aircraft is like at altitude. Now, this is something that's really disturbing to me, and I wanted to point this out. In an interview, Eric Schramm, executive vice president for flight operations at Air France and a Boeing 777 captain, contested the need for such training. There's not a big difference. This is his quote. I hope that they're taking him out of context here, because it's just mind-boggling to me that this guy would say that high-altitude training is not a factor. Quote, there is not a big difference between high altitude and low altitude in manual flight, Mr. Schramm said. It is not a very important topic for us. Okay. If he is not being misquoted here, then I'm sorry. You're an idiot, sir. There is a big difference. That is just amazing to me that an executive vice president for flight operations would make that statement. Again, I'm going to give this guy the benefit of the doubt and assume that he was quoted out of context. Let's see. What else did I want to say here? Well, this article, again, kind of goes over everything I just talked about. They did say that, let's see, who was this? Mr. Voss from Flight Safety International, who was not involved in the investigation, but who recently participated in simulations of the crash with Airbus test pilots. His quote, they were pretty committed to it, he said, referring to the nose-up action. Your arm gets very tired trying to duplicate what was going on, Mr. Voss said of the crash simulation. The nose was being held up very aggressively for quite a long time. Okay, and as I mentioned before, the Captain Marc Dubois, 58 years old, a veteran pilot who had flown nearly 11,000 hours. He was the captain of the flight, pilot in command. He has extensive experience on the Airbus A330 and 340 aircraft. David Robert, 37 years old, was the first co-pilot with more than 6,500 hours of flight experience, 4,500 of them on A330s. And Pierre Cedric Bonin, 32 years old, the second co-pilot, had under 3,000 hours of experience. And he was the one that was at the controls when this whole thing began and they lost control. Okay. Mr. Bouillard, the lead investigator, said it was still too early in the investigation to say definitively that the pilots were unaware that the plane was in an aerodynamic stall. He noted that an audible whine by the engines, which was picked up on the recovered cockpit recordings, combined with a buffeting of the aircraft as air spilled over the top of the wings, might have been misinterpreted as an overspeed situation, which would also cause buffeting. All we know is that there was a stall warning, and then there was a reaction that is not the appropriate one for a stall. Okay, and also interestingly, they're going to convene a group of a working group here. Let's see, what do they call that? A working group that includes behavioral psychologists and experts in cockpit design and ergonomics, and they're going to be charged with trying to find an answer to such questions. He said their findings will likely be included in the investigator's final report, which is expected early next year. Since the Flight 447 accident, both Airbus and Boeing have modified their stall recovery procedures with guidance from air safety regulators in the United States and Europe. Safety experts say that these procedures are now essentially the same for both aircraft makes, regardless of altitude, and instruct pilots in the first instance to lower the nose of the aircraft and, if necessary, to reduce thrust to avoid excessive acceleration. Previously, the standard procedure for an approaching stall at low altitude was to raise the nose by about 5 degrees and to maintain full thrust. Okay. And interestingly, the airplane that I fly is the McDonnell Douglas MD-88, which McDonnell Douglas was bought out by Boeing Aircraft several years ago. And technically speaking, now Boeing owns the MD-88, so any of the manuals or procedures that we get are actually from Boeing. And so this report mentioned that both Boeing and Airbus have changed or modified their stall recovery procedures. And interestingly, in a flight crew bulletin at ACME I received for my fleet back in May, dated May 3rd, the subject is approach to stall recovery, and they talk about these very issues as far as the proper thing to do at high altitude or low altitude for recovering from a stall. So I can confirm that this is indeed happening. So that's the good thing. You know, anytime we have an accident, we learn from it. And I always say that I hope to learn from other people's mistakes. And so it shouldn't have happened to begin with, but now that it has, it's really kind of shedding some light on several areas. And of course, those of you who follow me on this podcast know how I feel about autoflight systems and our dependence upon them and the lack of flying skills that I'm seeing from newer generation pilots, because they've grown up in this world of autoflight. And I think that finally we're starting to see that this is not such a great thing, and we're going to probably start seeing more emphasis put on maintaining our flying skills. As a side note, I was remarking with a fellow crew member the other day that when I was hired by ACME more than 22 years ago, when we went into the simulators to do our training, I'd say probably 80-90% of the time we were hand-flying the aircraft, the simulator, that is. And over the years, I noticed a tendency to put more and more emphasis on immediately turning the autopilot on and having the autopilot fly the aircraft. And I don't know, you know, again, is that part of the problem, that over the years we've kind of evolved into this culture of letting the autoflight systems completely do everything for us, and we're just losing our skills? I think so. Okay, now let's move on to another subject. You may have seen this in the news as well. Well, let's see. Let me take you back almost 40 years ago, the night before Thanksgiving, 1971. A man calling himself Dan Cooper, wearing a suit and raincoat, walked up to the Northwest Orient desk at Portland Airport in the United States Pacific Northwest and spent $20 on a one-way ticket to Seattle. On the plane, he donned a pair of dark sunglasses, ordered a whiskey, lit up a cigarette, I remember those days, and coolly handed the stewardess a note. In capital letters, it read, "I have a bomb in my briefcase. I will use it if necessary. I want you to sit next to me. You are being hijacked." What happened next would ensure Cooper a place in the pantheon of American folk heroes. He asked the stewardess to relay the following request to the captain. He wanted $200,000 and 4 parachutes, and in return, he'd allow 36 people to leave the aircraft when the plane landed in Seattle. The FBI organized the swap, and when the plane was skybound again, with just the pilot, co-pilot, one stewardess, and Cooper on board, his instructions were to head for Mexico, maintaining an altitude under 10,000 feet. Now, the story doesn't say that he requested that it be unpressurized, but I'm pretty sure that he did. Then, somewhere over the lower Cascade Mountains, 25 miles northwest of Portland, Cooper released the plane's aft stairs, stepped out, and with one of the parachutes strapped to his back, jumped into the stormy night and was never seen or heard from again. Well, that is until just recently. Investigators said that they are testing the fingerprints of a new suspect after what they said is the most promising lead to date in its bid to crack America's only unsolved hijacking. So, we'll see what happens with that. I'll keep you up to date if they actually find that this suspect is actually D.B. Cooper or Dan Cooper. By the way, I flew the 727 for a total of about 10 years, and on the air stairs of the 727 is a latch that they call the D.B. Cooper latch. Yep, named after this guy, because as the story goes, you know, he was at 10,000 feet, unpressurized, and opened the air stair doors, and they're hydraulically actuated, and so they will open, and he jumped out of the aircraft. Since then, the D.B. Cooper latch, or the latch that they placed on the aircraft, and everybody just refers to it as the D.B. Cooper latch, what happens is that when the airstream flows over it, it moves the latch to a closed position, so you cannot open the aft air stairs in flight. But as soon as the airspeed decreases below a certain point, then that spring-loaded latch moves out of the way, and then the lower air stairs can be lowered. And the MD-88 also has air stairs as well, but they are not hydraulically, well, they are hydraulically actuated, but they don't have, actually they're hydraulically actuated to be retracted or pulled up into the airplane, but you cannot extend them under power like that. They just kind of drop down with gravity, so would not be a factor on an MD-88. Okay, shifting to different kind of news. You know, I mentioned in my last podcast about the airlines not collecting the 7.5% federal taxes on ticket sales starting, I don't know, just a few weeks ago. You know, the government lost the authority to collect those taxes, and several airlines were just raising their base rates to make up for that 7.5%, and they were just pocketing the money. Well, of course, the public and me were kind of chastising them for that, and Delta Airlines on Monday announced that it would refund federal taxes to customers on flights booked before the FAA shutdown. So good news. At least one airline out there is doing the right thing, giving the money back. Now, here is something that happened last week at the 2011 EAA Air Venture in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, the yearly fly-in that they hold there, sponsored by the Experimental Aircraft Association. And on Thursday of last week, a flight of two F-16s were kind of putting on a show there, coming in and doing some pattern maneuvers, and then they landed, and this is what happened, unfortunately. Let's take a listen.
Bama 1136 left cleared to land. Thanks for the show. Wind 1605.
Antonio, Bama 11 flight cleared land.
All right, landing really good. Flying a long roll to the end. Ball, flight.
Bama 11, welcome. Bama 11 space gear, full stop.
Yeah, Bama 11, and welcome to Oshkosh. Thanks for that show.
Happy day. Bama 11, thank you. Glad to be here. Roll the trucks.
I thought he was passing
off the bow. Now roll the trucks. We've got the Viper off the end of the runway.
Yeah, didn't turn out very well for the number two guy, I believe. Yeah, ended up landing a little bit too long on this very short runway there, and continued off the end, and the nose wheel sank into the wet ground at the on the other side of the runway, and it kind of just sank in, and everybody was safe. A little bit of damage, maybe a lot of damage to the F-16, but I'll have a link to the YouTube video in my show notes. It's pretty impressive in a negative sort of way. And now, let's switch to some feedback.
Message for you, sir.
All right. Let's see. This is from Dan Felton in the United Kingdom. Hello, sir. I'm new to listening to your podcasts. I thought I should drop you a quick line to say well done for an excellent, well-produced, and informative take on aviation. I particularly enjoy the slant toward air safety issues. I'm from the UK, but I've done plenty of flying in the United States. Cheers and wishing you happy, safe flying. And I wrote back to Dan and thanked him for his feedback and asked him about his flying and if he's a pilot and if he's, you know, because he mentioned he's done plenty of flying in the United States. And he mentioned that that he is working on his licenses and, again, and it's his intention to fly commercially. And like me, he has made up his mind, or did make up his mind at an early age, that this is what he wanted to do. You know, that I mentioned in my first podcast that while I was in college, kind of got a little off track as to what I was thinking I was going to do with my life as far as what I was going to do as a job. And realized that, you know what, I've always wanted to fly. And so I dropped out of engineering and shifted over to aviation management, went into the Air Force, and the rest is, as they say, history. But anyway, he mentioned that the same kind of thing happened to him. He was studying mechanical engineering at university, but somehow wasn't pursuing what really made him buzz. And then he switched into aviation, and it all clicked into place. So... he says, doing anything other than to do with flying, I'm a fish out of water, as they say. And let's see. One of the reasons I found your podcasts is whilst looking at renewing my licenses ratings, having been disengaged from flying for some time, 5 years, in fact. I hope it's never too late to get into flying for a living somewhere, somehow. I am 36 years old. Anyway, sorry for rambling. It's good to talk to an experienced, like-minded aviator. Keep up the great work, Jeff. I will. Thank you, Dan. And 36 years old? I don't think that's too old anymore. You know, the retirement age now is up to 65 years old, and probably won't take long to get those ratings up to speed again and get hired by a regional airline. And I've been reading several things that say that we're facing a pilot shortage here in the future. Now, I'd like to say I'll believe it when I see it, because I've heard this for the last 10, 15 years, and that has yet to materialize. So I'm kind of skeptical about this pilot shortage, but a lot of people, a lot of smart people are saying that it is going to happen. So this may be a very good time, even for somebody 36 years old, to get into the business. So thanks again, Dan, for your feedback. Also received some feedback from Gary Moshier. I'm not sure how you pronounce your last name, Gary. I'm sorry if I'm mangling it. Anyway, he's from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. He says, love your show. Thought you would enjoy this, although it's missing the little arrows around the wings that make it fly. And he's referring to, and I mentioned this on my Catholic Pilot podcast last year, a picture of a jet that is painted this bright green and has all these things like pointing to the cockpit. It says the big cheese and in parentheses, Captain, oh, Captain, or Captain, my Captain. It's, it has some arrows pointing to the engines that say engines. And so like everything's labeled on the outside of this thing. It's very humorous. And in fact, going along in the internet, these pictures were last year, and a lot of people thought it was just somebody that had photoshopped this paint job on a 737 and didn't think it was really true. But if you go to any of the myth-busting sites, you'll find that, oh, no, this indeed is really a paint job. And the name of the airline is Kalula. I think that's the way you pronounce it. And they're from South Africa. And not only do they have a crazy paint job called Flying 101, which is the one that Gary included in his email to me, but they also have several other versions of wacky paint jobs. One says in huge letters with some big giant arrows, this way up. And they have another version called the, let's see what, the Jet Setter. They have one that, they have just several that have very humorous paint jobs, very clever paint jobs on them. So I'll put a link in my show notes to some of these photos from Kalula Airlines. Unfortunately, I won't be able to use any of these pictures in my podcast posting because I don't have permission to use these photos, and somebody could sue me if I did. So you'll just have to go to the link and see it for yourself. And you, too, can send feedback. Feedback at Airline Pilot Guy. Again, that's feedback at airlinepilotguy.com. And I have some voice or a voice feedback line. That's area code 304-99-PILOT, 304-997-4568. And mentioned last week, you know, I had a good tip for my favorite aviation news podcast. So if you're looking for some well-produced and serious and accurate and just overall well done, I think the best out there for aviation news and not so much commentary like what you get from me, go to the Daily Aero News Network podcast hosted by Paul Plack. And you can tell he's a professional broadcaster, and you can tell I'm not. And you can find that at aero-news.net. I also asked you about what your favorite weather website is or your favorite weather / radar app, and none of you responded. So I'm still looking for that. So I'm not going to do another question this week until I get some responses for that. So. And let's see, you can find me on Facebook, Captain Jeff, or Airline Pilot Guy. On Twitter, Airline Pilot Guy, all one word. And of course, my website, airlinepilotguy.com. You're seeing a common theme here, obviously. Okay. And remember, it's always a beautiful day above the clouds. And until we meet again, wishing you blue skies, unlimited visibility, and tailwinds. Take care, and God bless.
That was terrible!
Horrendous!
I'm offended!
I'm appalled!
So what are we gonna do?
What else? Email it to everybody we know!
Good idea.